This is kind of idea you branded this way and then you apply for a grant proving that they bite in. So I'm very grateful to be back at PI after so many years, and I'd like to thank Celine and Luca for the invitation. I also have the honor of being the last speaker, which means that I think I get to speak for everyone and tell Luca and Celine that we are very, very impressed with the beautiful conference that they organized and how they've been able to put together this different group of people in spite of, you know, all the difficulties after the COVID. I know by personal experience that organizing conferences is still hard. So I think we should thank them very much also for the support that they received from the staff at Perimeter Institute. So why don't we start by clapping? In fact, when I saw the program of the conference, I was kind of disappointed because there was no sport event next to it, like a football tournament or something. But then I realized there was no need because you guys managed to kind of fusion a physics conference with playing volleyball all together at the same time. And I think this is really amazing. And I absolutely want to buy one of those for my next conferences. So this is great. Being the last speaker of the conference, it also means that I have nobody after me. So I'm planning on talking for 2.5 hours, more or less. No, seriously, I'll try to be within time, and you can use the hockey stick if I'm late. So let me start by motivating what I would like to talk about. It's actually not really that many new results that I will present. It's more like thoughts, reflections about how the things that we have been working on from different viewpoints in the last few years should talk to one another. And in particular, I think it would be very useful, especially to this kind of new community that is growing up, to see if we can get some consensus and make sure that we agree on some basic stuff. And so even if some of the things, or most of the things maybe that I'm going to say, will be already known to you, I hope that even to the expert, this is going to be useful for this purpose. So if you want the motivation for this talk and these reflections, is this very well-known paper by Walden Zupas that more than 20 years ago showed how you can recover this very famous Bondi energy loss formula and much more, starting from the covariant phase space formalism applied at SCRI. And in the years since, the covariant phase space formalism has been enriched. New things have been understood, the mathematics and also the physics of it have been developed. And in particular, two things that are prominent into the discussion these days are the presence of field-dependent diffeomorphism and anomalies. So the obvious question is, Walden Zupas never really talked about field-dependent anomalies, field-dependent diffeomorphisms, nor anomalies, but both things appear in the BMS group. So how come they got the right result? And if they already had the right result, what's new, what's needed from these new developments that we are been working on? So answering these questions is the goal of my talk, and it's organized like this. First, some motivations, why it's interesting to talk about field-dependent diffeos and anomalies. Then, how can we understand these questions about the Walden-Zupas procedure and these structures? And then I will conclude with two examples. One is short and one is longer and maybe more interesting. So let's start from the field-dependent diffeomorphisms. There are various reasons to consider them. The first, people are more familiar with, I'm sure, here, is the fact that when you do gauge fixing, it's typical to end up working with symmetry vector fields whose extension depends on the fields, on the dynamical fields. For instance, in the case of the BMS, the tangential part of the asymptotic Killing vectors is fixed by the symmetry. It doesn't depend on the metric. I'm talking about BMS, not extended or generalized. The first order structure that's very important, the first order extension is also uniquely fixed. Whereas starting from the second order on, this is arbitrary, it depends on your choice of coordinates in the bulk, and we see that there's dependence on the dynamical fields. Same thing actually happens on a finite horizon, on a finite nullable surface. You have the tangential part, which is fixed by just the symmetry parameters. The first order extension is uniquely fixed, and the rest is junk. It depends on your choice of coordinates. So same structure in these two cases. This part also will depend on the metric. Anticipating on something I'd like to come back to, notice that here there's two there's two terms here that are fixed. Here there's only one. Actually, this is not by chance. This somehow, even though it's just a technical details, is part of the reasons why Scry is so different than a null hypersurface at a finite distance. So we will come back to this at the end. So that's cage fixing is one example. For those of you that were at the Loops conference this summer, one of the plenary talk was by Madhavan Varadarajan. He was using parametrization of the shape vectors that depends on the electric field in order to simplify the structure of the constraint, of the Hamiltonian constraint. And so that's another situation in which you get field-dependent diffeomorphisms, because if you want the shift, it's part of the choice of coordinates. And of course, slicing is another well-known example in which we are interested in doing this. That's to motivate the field-dependent diffeomorphisms, to motivate the anomalies. That's an even older thing, because already Sachs in 62, when he computed the transformations of the asymptotic shear under the BMS transformations, he immediately saw that that was not a Lie derivative. So if you want, the fact that things in the covariant phase space transform in a different way as their space-time tensorial nature would dictate is known since forever. Now, in this modern language that we use, we understand this discrepancy as the presence of some background structure that is breaking covariance. So we call it anomaly, but we could also just call it non-covariance due to the presence of this background. What is this background structure? Well, in the case of BMS, it's the conformal factor. In the case of some boundary at finite distance, it would be, for instance, the scalar field that tells me where the boundary is. So the notation I will use for the bicomplex is this is the space-time part, and this is the field space part. It has the advantage of being the less baroque possible, so it's as simple as possible. With respect to the beautiful introduction that was given by Adrien on Monday, there are two notational differences. One is that I use a commutator here, whereas Adrien was using an anti-commutation, but that's just like a convention. Apart from some relative signs, everybody kind of agrees that there should be no differences in the result, so that you can take it as a choice. There's another aspect of the notation, though, that I'm more I have more opinionated about, and I think that we should really stop using this notation here. I mean, I've learned the covariant phase space with that notation that dates back, I guess, to Wald. But I think it's not very good for two reasons. First of all, because it's kind of ambiguous. There are people in the literature that mean by this, they mean a one form. But then this notation is really kind of bad because, you know, it's like if you have a one form in space-time and you write it as half of x dx, right? So it's not really a very practical notation. Then there's people that by these, they mean a vector field. Then the notation is okay, of course, but it means that this is not the one form, this is the one form hooked up to the vector field, and that leads to some ugly formulas, like, you know, when you write the symplectic two form, you have to write something like this. And I remember a few years ago when I was working with this notation thinking that was the only one, I think Aldo was the first one that pointed out that this is just ugly notation due to these conventions, and it's better to just think of delta really as the equivalent of D, a one for the exterior derivative in field space, and then we just call theta one form. We don't write these because the same way as we don't write these in space-time, and then, you know, omega would just be delta. Or omega, I'm calling it now. So that's my suggestion to simplify the notation, and that's the notation I'm going to use, in which this I is the internal product in field space. I'm going to use a shorthand notation by which the vector field in field space associated to diffeomorphism, so this would be the integral in dx, leak psi of the fields d over d phi. These, I'm just going to refer it as psi, and so, or better, these I will never need, but I, psi, I'm going to just use this shorthand notation. Now, I know Adrien doesn't like the shorthand notation because is really not the internal product with Xi, but rather with this. But there is no ambiguity, really. So put up with me for that. And then this delta Xi is really the lead derivative in field space. OK. So with these notations, let's talk about then background structures. So suppose that the covariant phase space has two types of fields, dynamical fields, and background fields that don't transform. So for the dynamical fields, we posit that the transformation in the covariant phase space is the lead derivative. Let's posit. We define it like this. On the other hand, for the background fields, not being part of the dynamics, they don't transform, so delta phi is zero, so also delta xi of phi is zero. But they are scalars or tensors, whatever they are, they have non-trivial lead derivative acting on them. So already here you have this discrepancy, and that's what we're going to call the anomaly. So if we now have any functional that depends on both dynamical fields and background fields, when we take this variation, we just use the derivatives of the derivative of the functions, and then we see that these guys don't transform, whereas this guy transforms with the lead derivative. So the first piece is this. The second piece, I don't know, here there are some typos, I'm afraid. Yeah, here there are, okay. Forget this equation, there's lots of typos. Yeah, I guess, so far it's good. No, here is F is missing. And then this is zero because it's a background field. So when I want to rewrite this as the lead derivative of everything, this will be correct, or this piece will be missing, and so I have to subtract it. And so at the end, the anomaly is the fact that this minus that is given by this term, the transformation of the background. I'm sorry about that. See, I haven't finished my talk even 5 minutes before. But... yes, I'm really sorry about that. So actually, for my punishment, I'll do the calculation, get it wrong, and be humiliated in front of everyone. So the definition is then really with Cartan's formula, where this xi is the shorthand notation for this. And so the anomaly is the fact that, you know, this would be d, g, f, and then delta xi g plus d, phi, this background field f, delta xi f. Now this is leak psi of g, this is zero. So if I want to rewrite this as leak psi of f, well, this piece would be missing. So it would be minus d phi f leak psi phi. And therefore, delta xi minus leak psi of f equals minus d phi of f leak psi phi. So that would be the anomaly on this scalar functional. If it is not a scalar functional but a one form in field space, there's an extra term that pop up, which is this guy here. And so this is the anomaly operator. I think the blame for the name anomaly goes to Lorondo, not to Anthony, in the papers with, but I'm not sure. Anyway. I'm giving this. Great, excellent. Sorry about that. Oops. Good. Now, let's continue with the. Okay, so that's the formal definition. Now, when can this happen that we have such anomalies? Well, for instance, let's suppose that we introduce a boundary, and then we have some Cartesian equation that localizes the boundary, and then we can have the normal one form with some. Which is the gradient of the scalar field up to some function f, which we are free to choose initially as we want. So if I look only at the residual diffeomorphisms, namely those that preserve the boundary, let's say the lateral boundary B, they have to be tangent to it, and then restricts them to have a structure like this, where this psi bar has no component, no normal component, and therefore, and whatever has a phi component has to die on the boundary. Okay. So that's the most general vector field that I can write compatible to this. Then I can compute the anomaly associated with this vector field. That's the formula I get. And from this formula, you can deduce that if you choose like a gradient, then this guy is zero. And the anomaly then comes from this extension of the vector field off the hypersurface. So what the anomaly is measuring is that my vector field was tangential at the boundary, but then is not tangential to the other leaves of this foliation. And the anomaly can be completely eliminated if we choose the unit norm. So if we work with a specific choice of F, then there are no anomalies. So this means that the anomaly is not just capturing the presence of the boundary, but rather some foliation dependence that a non-unit normal has. And this fact already tells us that, well, if we work with null hypersurfaces, we would be up a creek, because there's no way to unit normalize the normal of a null hypersurface. And so you can tell that anomalies are going to be important in the case of null surfaces. So, for instance, the anomaly of the null normal will percolate to all quantities that we usually compute, such as the expansion of the null hypersurface, the volume form, all of these depend on L, and so will also be anomalous. Nonetheless, the pullback of the Einstein-Hilbert sympathetic potential is not anomalous. One can check that is expected because it comes from the Einstein-Hilbert action, which is completely non-anomalous. But if you start looking at piece by piece, then in general the individual pieces are not covariant. It's just the old thing in which the non-covariant things cancel out. Okay. So this will be then relevant. So okay, this is just to motivate why we're interested in these things, field-dependent diffeos and anomalies. Now, how do we understand these things in the phase space? So let me explain this using probably the most famous formula of the covariant phase space, which is the formula for the canonical generator. So that's expression we find already in Ironwald 94, and then is the one that is used in Wold-Zupas. There are no field-dependent diffeomorphisms nor anomalies. Attention to field-dependent diffeomorphism dates back to shortly after the Wold-Zupas paper. And Glenn, for me, it's already kind of like implicit here, but maybe the first time this formula appears with explicitly this term is true that it's in this paper by Glenn and Geoffrey in 2005. And then the contribution of the last couple of years is this anomalous extra piece here, which let me tell you where it comes from. So this general setup for including these things that I'm going to use makes one assumption only, which is that if there are anomalies, they are a boundary term. They're not necessarily bulk contributions, meaning that we are looking at theories for which there always is a covariant choice of bulk Lagrangian. So, you know, like Chern-Simons would be excluded. But nonetheless, for the case of gravity in four dimensions, this is pretty good enough to include ADM, Einstein-Cartan, Einstein-Hilbert, and all the choices that we usually have. So then with this assumption, I refer to little a as the boundary, as the anomaly of the boundary Lagrangian. And this capital A would be the anomaly of the sympathetic potential, which, however I choose it, will be related to the anomaly of the boundary Lagrangian in this way. Then you just redo exactly the same calculations that Ironwald did 30 years ago, and you just find that there is an extra piece like this in the formula for the nether current, and that there's an extra piece like this in the formula for the canonical generators. I don't want to derive them, it's easy, you can look at the paper. I want to rather comment on what they mean individually. So first of all, in the nether current, let's take the pullback of this nether current on the lateral boundary, and xi we restrict it to be tangent so that it preserves the boundary, so this term dies. That's a standard flux of the variation of the nether current, and now we have this piece also. So the anomaly kind of like, the Lagrangian anomaly kind of like pollutes, so to speak, the flux of the nether charge by telling us that it's not only due to the symplectic flux, but there's also a contribution that comes from some non-geometric choices, some background choices that have been made. And giving examples of what this means is part of the reasons of this talk. For the sympathetic anomaly that appears here, well, it just appears as another contribution to another potential obstruction to non-integrability. Let me remind you that the non-integrability that appears here is due to the fact that we have this lateral flux. So it's the sympathetic form that actually is not conserved, and therefore they're naturally vector fields which are not Hamiltonian because they move the corner in the direction in which it sees the non-conservation of the symplectic form. And so there's a long list of beautiful ideas that are explored in the literature with different motivations, different goals, in order to extract a definition of Hamiltonian out of this system, which is non-conservative, and so it doesn't have an Hamiltonian in the standard sense. The improved Lyapunov charge, the Wolff-Zopas procedure, simply studying path independent in field space, in the sense that you look at this as an infinitesimal one form, and then the fact that it's non-integrable just means that it's integral, it's path dependent. Slicing techniques that I've already mentioned. Other reasons to take special prescriptions rather than others that has been already discussed earlier this morning. And more recently also extension of the phase space. So it's really a rich area in which many ideas can be discussed, and I don't have time to go into the details of this. Unfortunately, I will just have to focus on this first two, which is the topic of the talk. So let's start with the improved Lyapunov charge. So the idea there is that we should work with a symplectic potential that has a special property that we require, namely that if we impose conservative boundary conditions, namely we look at situational restrictions on the phase space, such as that there's no flux on the lateral boundary, then the pullback of the symplectic potential should vanish. Because in that way, we're certain that, you know, conservative means that these charges will be conserved in this case. So to achieve that, what do we do? Well, we decompose the pullback of whatever theta we're starting with in this form, such that theta prime is on the form P delta Q for some choice of polarization. Doesn't matter which one in principle. This way, either we fix conservative boundary conditions, delta Q equals zero, or we fix P equal to zero, then we will achieve what we want, namely that the pullback of this new symplectic potential is conserved, and therefore the new Lyapunov charge associated with this theta prime, as opposed to the initial theta, will be naturally conserved. Now, both actually ideas are useful, and both have used in the literature, so maybe then we can debate on the values of both, but let me do this at the end. This is what we use most in the case of the time-like case, and this is what we use most in the case of the null boundary, in which we're interested in leaky boundary conditions. So by changing the symplectic potential from theta to theta prime, we obtain a new Lyapunov charge, which has the same structure, but now refers to this new symplectic potential, and to a new Lagrangian, which is L plus D little l. And this turns out to be related to the initial one by this formula here. So this formula appears already in Iyer and Wald, but still I would like to distinguish it from just the bare charge, the bare Lyapunov charge, and call this improved Lyapunov charge, because as Iyer and Wald proved, if you start from the bare symplectic potential for Einstein and Hilbert, this piece here gives you the Comar formulas, which we all know give wrong factors of two, both for the ADM mass and for the Bondi mass. So for a long time, people wanted to correct this, and one of the merits of this work of Wald was to show how you can consistently correct that. And so that's why this new charge can be called improved.
You're not going to tell me that I have 5 minutes left, right?
I saw you
standing up ahead. Moment of
Do you have a comment on the fact that the anomalies drop out? So I don't know if you start with Einstein Hilbert at the end of the day.
I will absolutely comment on this.
Okay.
Yes, it's exactly on what happens. Right. So now, this is a delicate slide, because you see these two papers, they have slightly or maybe quite different viewpoints in that the way we worked in the covariant phase space formalism, there's this story of the cohomological ambiguities, and they are handled them very differently in these two papers. In the paper with Laurent, Daniele, and Roberto, we just fix them once and for all using the homotopy operator, which you can always do. And in fact, Wald himself suggests this idea. Glenn also does it. So it's quite common to fix all the anomalies in this way. On the other hand, in this paper, they took the viewpoint of not fixing anything at start, so to work with equivalent classes of Lagrangians at the boundary terms, and the symplectic potentials up to exact terms. And then the idea was just to fix the ambiguities by imposing a certain form of PDQ here, which fixes everything up to a corner ambiguity here, which you then have to fix on top. So to get a unique charge, either you give me both boundary and bulk Lagrangian and the prescription of the homotopy operator, or you fix this theta prime once and for all. But then you also have to fix the boundary Lagrangian L, or as they say in Antonin's paper, the corner flux, in order to get a unique charge. Now, what I would like to say is that in spite of sometimes misunderstandings when people talk to one another, it doesn't really matter if you take this one viewpoint or the other viewpoint. The results are really the same. Of course, if you're with the homotopy operator, this formula is nicely symmetric because everything here is an improvement of the charge, just refers to different Lagrangians. Whereas in this other viewpoint, you would think of this as the ambiguous Noether charge associated with this guy that has not been fixed. Whereas this one is associated with this guy that has been fixed. And then if you fix also the boundary Lagrangian, everything is invariant. Now I hope that I don't, because both Laurent and Anthony are in the audience, I hope they agree with this. I know I'm walking a fine line, so there are no complaints. So that means I've managed not to hit the on button, and I'm very happy of that. So everybody agrees, so that's great. Good. Now, one nice thing that you can do with the anomalies also is better understand this famous co-cycle of Glenn and Cedric. So once we've found our prescription for the charge, doesn't matter really how, we're going to split this into an integrable piece and a flux term. Then the next question to ask is, well, is now that we have some prescription for the charge, can we actually claim that these charges reproduce the algebra that they're supposed to? Now, in standard situations, as Andrea reminded us on Monday, we have this representation theorem up to a central charge. We are guaranteed that this is going to work. But in the presence of flux, this is not conserved. This may not be Hamiltonian vector fields. This equation doesn't hold anymore. Glenn and Cedric's idea was to get a new prescription for the bracket in which the flux is carefully subtracted. You have to do it in the right signs and right way. So what you get is now not an inverse of the symplectic two form, but what they were able to show is that they get a representation of the algebra up to some cocycle. So not a central extension, this is a field-dependent cocycle. So that was great. And one thing that you can do on top of this by discussing anomalies is that actually you can compute this cocycle from scratch for an arbitrary theory, no matter what the Lagrangian is, and verify that it satisfies the Jacobian identity in general. So we have this formula here for the cocycles. And this formula, this piece already played a role in some previous papers by Anthony, and similar formulas have been also derived in these other papers. So there's quite a solid evidence for this construction. Now that you have these, not only we are more confident about the validity of this Jacobian identity in general for this definition of the bracket, you can also decide to throw these in the definition of the bracket if you wanted, so that you get a representation of the algebra pure and simple. Significantly, there exists an off-shell version also of this formula, which is given by this, and this plays a role in Laurent's program that he described the other day in the morning, that the larger the symmetry group, the more Einstein's equations you can derive by imposing that that symmetry group gives a closed algebra. So that's an interesting and powerful new viewpoint on the derivation of gravitational dynamics. And there's more recent work also on understanding this bracket also as a Poisson bracket in an extended phase space, which I don't have time to talk about.
Okay.
Okay, good. So that was for the improved Noether charge. Now, the Wolff-Zupas charge.
Sorry, what time did I start?
An hour more.
Okay, good. So that means I'm probably speaking very fast, or it's okay? It's okay?
You understand okay. Me? I say you have 5 minutes.
No, you said half an hour. Okay, a question so far?
So that was for the iron walled improved Noether charge.
Maybe there is one question you might ask. Okay, but if this was iron walled already, oops, so maybe that's... Why do we often quote Harlow for this formula? Well, because he added something quite nice to it, which was the fact that for iron walled, one should not touch the symplectic two form omega. And so they really wanted to use this formula only in situations in which this term was absent. And you can do this, for instance, on a time-like boundary if you require that this time-like boundary is orthogonal with respect to the space-like boundary. But if not, if it's not orthogonal, if you allow for it to be an arbitrary angle, then you cannot get rid of this term. And so Harlow's contribution was to point out that in that case, you are forced to change the symplectic two form from omega to omega prime according to the delta of this formula. And then you get the Brown-York charge also using it.
It's why I'm between the omega and the symplectic current. So maybe here's different. So,
Of course, they discussed this, absolutely. I meant about this formula, this expression for the charge. They have this expression for the charge in iron walled.
Okay.
But you see that this expression for the charge makes reference to an omega prime associated with this theta prime, which they don't want, because this term changes omega. You see, this ambiguity here does not change omega. This ambiguity changes omega, and they don't want to allow that. So because they don't want to allow that, they don't want to allow this in the shift in the charge. And so what Harlow and then the papers by Laurent, Mark, and Daniele nicely pointed out is that actually there is really no issue in allowing for also this term and taking into account the fact that we're changing omega. That's fine, and you still get the Brown-York formulas.
Maybe, yeah, I wanted to comment on your question. I mean, I would be more strong. I think what Harlow showed is that there's an hypothesis in our world that a boundary Lagrangian, they assume that the boundary Lagrangian doesn't change the symplectic potential, and that is not correct.
It changes the symplectic potential like this.
No, but you can add
change the symplectic two form.
Yeah, but it's independent. There's no connection between changing the boundary. In their formulation, they say that you can either, you know, you have an exact term. So
Let me make the statement in a non-ambiguous way. Iron walled are able to derive the Brown-York charges with orthogonal corners. With non-orthogonal corners, they can't. You need to introduce this term, and that's what Arno and you guys also do. I think that's the quantitative statement. Would you agree with that?
Sure. They also say that anyway, they also say something wrong, but
okay.
Which
okay.
You know, they also say that somehow a boundary Lagrangian doesn't change the. Well, anyway, so Harlow makes that clear.
Sorry, just a slightly side question. Can you go back to the where you had the cocycle, the field dependent cocycle? So the question is, do you know if there is some algebraic interpretation of this structure, something that...
That's a question for Glenn.
But, I mean, is it known? Is it something that's been...
Well, it is a Lie algebraic two cocycle in the end.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I like those answers, so quick, so crisp. Great. Okay. Now, the Wong-Zopas prescription, right here, sorry. So, this is 15 years after the Ironwald paper, more or less. So, let's look again at the formula for the Hamiltonian generator. I'm going to look at it from the modern perspective in which we allow for everything inside. Anyway, the logic is what matters here. So, they discuss two situations in which integrability occurs. One is when, if all of this, it's the delta of something in phase space. Then you have kind of like trivial integrability. The only thing that is happening is the shift from the initial nether charge to by x, shift that they were happy with, because as I already pointed out, for instance, if you start from Comar, you are happy to shift it. That's the case that is relevant at spatial infinity. And then there's what they call case two, which is that doesn't happen. The sum of these is not the delta of some function in phase space. Nonetheless, it is the xi of some bar theta that has some physically recognizable and unambiguous form.
Okay, so the physical input here is very important. Because only in that case, you can justify, well, I'm going to shove these on the left-hand side and define a charge that is physically meaningful. So let's look at the prescription first for this flux, this physically meaningful flux, and then for the charge. So to identify such a preferred potential, they go in a sequence of steps. First of all, you require that the sympathetic potential, this physical one, this preferred one, is a good sympathetic potential for the fullback, for the pullback of omega on the lateral boundary. So you see, they don't allow for omega or omega prime. That's why they don't allow for a var theta here. That's the only freedom they have with respect to the initial sympathetic potential. And it's quite important that this freedom turns out to be enough. So that's the first thing. Then how to select it? Because in their perspective, there's infinitely many sympathetic potentials. In our perspective with the homotopy operator, we could say there's infinitely many boundary Lagrangians that we could add to. So you see, that's not an issue, the different viewpoints that one can take. And so they give these two requirements. First of all, it has to be a local and covariant functional of both dynamical fields and background structures. And it must vanish for some arbitrary perturbations around the stationary solution. This is what they propose. If this is not enough to single out one preferred potential, you might need to add some more requirements. This I just said, both the homotopy operator and ambiguity operator are both perfectly fine. We can adapt the same logic. We just use different words, but the logic is going to be the same. And typically in all situations that I know of, these two requirements are enough. One doesn't have to invert another one. Typically, this B is going to be non-zero, as we will see. So that's the prescription they give for the flux. Now we can try to say, well, is this some type of improved charge? Well, they never talk about boundary Lagrangian here, so it's not an improved Noether charge immediately. However, let's zoom in on this requirement. It must vanish for arbitrary perturbations around stationary solutions. Well, then immediately brings back one of those two options that I gave before. That means that somehow this theta bar has to be in the form P delta Q, where P is a function of matrix that vanishes on stationary solutions. That's what it means. It's a one form, so it's linear in delta Q, so that's what it means. That's suggestive that I can interpret this as some type of improved Noether charge with a boundary Lagrangian given by B. Or, if not B, there could be some corner ambiguity in whatever the boundary Lagrangian is, but this var theta can at most be a total variation. It cannot be a var theta, which is not a total variation because it's not permitted by their zeroth law, so to speak, here. So that could be already an interpretation as improved Noether charge, but let's see what they suggest as charge. What they suggest is that since I know what is the physical flux, I have my preferred flux, well, I just shove it on the left-hand side, as I was saying. So I just define the charge in this way. So if we go back to the general formula, we see that what we're doing is that we're throwing this on the left-hand side to put in the definition of the charge. If the blue terms here vanish, then that already gives me an integrable charge. So we know that it works. Now, the reason why I put this double slash here is that if these terms are present, it's less obvious that it works. So we can already anticipate that there will be some potential discrepancy if these terms are present. They allow for integrability, but they're non-zero. So the question now, though, is, okay, they give this prescription in a context in which they never talk about anomalies, they never talk about field-dependent diffeomorphisms explicitly, but are they aware that their procedure allows for such things? So we have to be a little bit of archaeology, and by this I really mean archaeology, because the answer is in a footnote, in a thick footnote of already thick paper, so it's not easy to dig out, but you can dig it out. And if you translate this in this modern language that I'm using, it gives you two very precise mathematical statements, which are these two. It's kind of obvious because if you remember the formula that I showed, in order for the flux to be given by just the term xi, okay, I will come back to it. Why it's kind of obvious that this is the result, but anyway, this is what you get for their definition. This doesn't mean that there are no anomalies, nor field-independent diffeos. It only means that theta bar is not anomalous, and that theta bar does not see whatever field dependency the xi's have. So I can turn these into restrictions for my Lagrangian and symplectic anomalies, and when I put them together, I get this formula. Now this is the beautiful formula I was showing to Adrien and Romain yesterday, which is an equation like this. So depending on your taste, you might find such an equation really ugly or really beautiful, but it's just saying that there's some interplay between the exactness in field space and exactness in space-time that has to be satisfied by the anomalies in field-dependent diffuse you allow. So we could call these mild anomalies, but I'm gonna rather call them soft anomalies because of what's going to happen at the end of the talk. And so in general, if they're present, what happens is that there is a shift between the improved net charge associated with B as bound by Lagrangian and the whole Zupas charge. And the shift is precisely such that the flux of the final charge is given just by xi of theta bar as Walden Zupas required, instead of being of having this anomalous contribution.
Simone?
So, yes?
Can I ask you a question? It's just a funny one, perhaps.
Funny one.
So if I were Anderson, I see that equation, I bring delta y to the left-hand side, and I say that that means that the total del d on the variation by complex of x minus y is zero.
Yes. Well,
does it mean, yes?
Of x minus zero.
Of x minus y. So I interpret that this d plus delta is actually d hat, some generalized by complex exterior derivative, and therefore that means that there is a combination of x and y that is closed. Does it mean that on the bicomplex x hat?
This I don't know, but let me tell you what I think is going on here.
Okay.
And if you know more about this, I'll be happy to learn.
Okay.
What I think it goes on here is that we have three, so we start from this equation, or in spelled out is this. I think we can distinguish only three cases. Either the theory is such that there's no anomalies at all, so this is 0 equals 0. In that case, Walden Zupas is an improved net charge, will be as bound by Lagrangian, we are done. Or these soft anomalies are present, but this equation is solved in a simple way by the fact that A bar is equal to ds, the d of something, where d is a local function in phase space. So that's the second option, and then there will be some discrepancy between the two procedures. And notice that if we start from a covariant Lagrangian, then A is zero, so this anomaly is entirely coming from the anomaly of B. So what we are saying is that in this case too, the anomaly of B must be an exact form in space-time. Third option, I look at this, and of course I said, well, with respect to this, I can always add some x, which is bulk, so it's not exact, but it's constant in phase space, so that it's killed by this delta. I don't know if you can go more general than this, but if you think that there might be subtleties and there's a fourth case, I'll be happy to know. Certainly, if you're in this situation, you're a little bit in trouble because you cannot get rid, so your surface charge now has a bulk term. Of course, it's a constant in phase space, so you can say, well, it's like a zero point in the energy, I throw it away. Ah, maybe you know if there is more.
Well, no, finish your.
No, I was just about to say that. That's it.
I have a question maybe about the previous slide. Do you know? So, if you do the Walden Zupas analysis, it was done in the context of the usual BMS.
I'll get there. It's the title of my talk.
I was asking about generalized BMS. Is that where you're going? I'll
comment on that a little bit. Generalized BMS is going to be a little bit tricky, so I won't have much to say yet, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But standard BMS, I've...
Sure. So all I was wondering is that there's this... I mean, because we know for generalized BMS that, in fact, you cannot... This condition, you're demanding that the... There's no anomaly, is not attainable.
Let's talk about this at the end.
Okay,
so three cases, or maybe Lucas' fourth case. This I don't know. So that's the general statement, and I hope it answers also your question. So you see, these are the possibilities. In Iwald or Wadzupas, you can allow for such situations, and then you have discrepancies. This is the general statement. So let's see now what happens in particular. I skipped the time-like and special infinity cases. We discussed them in the paper, but they're kind of more interesting for historical reasons than there's no, they're kind of trivial. So let me go straight to the case of null boundaries. First of all, null hypersurface at a finite distance. 15 more minutes?
12.
So the final distance case, So there's plenty of interesting things that have been discussed. many here a perimeter. I'm going to just zoom in on one example because I, as Luca just said, I don't have much time, which is the construction of Chandrasekharan, Flanagan, sorry about that, and Prabhu. This K-space is constructed imposing these restrictions, and it's very important to impose these restrictions if you want to satisfy the Wolzupas rules. Why? Because with these restrictions, that formula I gave you before collapses to this. Now we want to look for a preferred potential of this structure. It satisfies covariance and stationarity. The obvious candidate is this guy, and that would be the expression for B. Let's see if he satisfies covariance. Yes, because I've thrown away the infinity and because I've thrown away the Bondi gauge freedom, the spin one momentum, as Laurent used to call it. So that's actually satisfied. But you see, if you throw back in the infinity, it won't be satisfied anymore, this condition. Stationarity, in this case, is satisfied by non-expanding horizons. And then this is the resulting B. So now I'm going to ask the question whether the charge, the Wolzopas charge, is going to be an improved Noether charge or not. I have to compute the anomaly of this B. And the formulas there were already, I already shown them. Anthony and Van already had these formulas. And because they trivially cancel up, this thing is not anomalous. There's no anomaly shift. So the Wolzupas charge you get in this case is really is an improved Noether charge with such boundary Lagrangian. And there's no anomaly contribution to the flux. The covariant requirement, as I said, is important because if you don't have it, you could keep the infinity, for instance. But the problem of the infinity of L is that it's not a geometric quantity of the hypersurface. If I change the normalization the way I want, the infinity will change. If I decide that L is extended off the null hypersurface, not being hypersurface orthogonal or not being null, that also changes the infinity. So it's a quantity that depends on much more than the geometry of the null hypersurface. So allowing it means that your charge will depend on such non-geometric quantities as well. Stationarity requirement, on the other hand, maybe one can try to do better. For instance, the charges that we got are very good for describing non-expanding horizons because that's the stationarity requirement that is being satisfied. So on any non-expanding horizon, this will be conserved. But on the other hand, beyond the non-expanding horizon case, they're less good. Take, for instance, the case of a null cone. You take the area of a cross-section of a null cone, this changes, even though there's no flux whatsoever. So why is that happening, that the charge is non-conserved even though there's no flux? Well, because the null cone in Minkowski fails to satisfy the stationarity requirement that Wolzupas proposed. Well, actually, that Chandrasekharan, Flanagan, and Prabhu proposed the following Wolzupas. So one could look for alternative definitions such that, for instance, this case is ruled out. And this is one of the things that we investigate in this other paper that we are finishing. Okay, the last 10 minutes, the most interesting case for future null infinity. Now, disclaimer, we already know that the BMS charges are improved Noether charges because that's exactly what we computed during those crazy days of COVID pandemics in which you're spending hours in front of Zoom and not moving much. Unfortunately, at least we had the satisfaction of understanding and learning these things. So we already know that that's the case, except that there, we knew the answer, we had our improved Noether charge, and we found the boundary Lagrangian that would map them. Now I want to derive them from scratch, not knowing them, but just computing anomalies. So what would be the Schreier symplectic potential? We do the same trick with the same analysis we just did, except that instead of being fully nicely covariant, I'm going to use Bondi coordinates, as everybody does. So that's the only difference. But morally, I'm doing the same thing. I'm just taking the pullback of the symplectic potential. Now it's cry. The notation, I use the one from our BMSW paper, but it's more or less standard. This is the shear, and this is the time derivative of the shear, and that's the mass aspect. So again, we want to identify the preferred symplectic potential. You look at this, and you say, beam, that's the guy. Is the only non-integrable guy after all. What else he can be? Okay? Let's see if it satisfies the test, the Wolzupas test. Well, stationarity is good because this vanishes for arbitrary perturbations around the vanishing new spacetime. So these are stationary spacetimes. So that's good. But is it covariant? Well, to see if it's covariant, we should look at the anomalies at Scry. So I'm going to start from the general framework that we have in BMSW. And then reduced to just BMS. So the transformations on the phase space are these. They are the ones also that Laura gave yesterday.
so you should have already seen them. This is the notation I use for the residual diffeomorphism with this function here. That's a Weyl factor. That for BMS is the divergence of y divided by 2, but for BMSW it's free. Now these quantities here, they live on this bundle of tensors on the sphere, but then they have this dependence on the retarded time of scry u. Now the Li derivative there is along this symmetry vector field is this, where this is abuse of notation, I just mean the Li derivative on a two sphere. And this is my definition of the Li derivative on this bundle here. So then what are the anomalies? Well, the anomalies are the fact that, you know, there are these extra terms, these density weights here and these inhomogeneous terms.
So
these anomalies.
Can I ask a question? Yeah, sorry, but I think I misunderstood what was an anomaly. I thought it was a difference. So at the beginning, you said there was you had delta xi phi and Li xi phi.
The anomaly is this difference here, you see, between delta xi, so the Li derivative in field space and the Li derivative in space time.
But that's the bulk Li derivative.
That's going to be, that's the bulk Li derivative, but no, well, it has to be the Li derivative in the covariant phase space that you construct. This Li derivative in the covariant phase space that I construct is not defined in the bulk, is defined by the data scry. And the data scry are m, the mass aspect I'm not giving it, and then this quantity is here.
Okay, so this is not the bulk, because the metric transform, the delta xi g mu nu is the Li derivative.
Yeah, if you want, okay, if you want to think in those terms, what you have to think about is that the discrepancy is coming from, so you have the physical metric, and then you have the unphysical metric here. Okay, and then you're going to define, you like, so this guy is equal to xi, but now this guy defines, you have to define some transformations here. So when you do this, sorry, now this is going to be equal to delta xi of this. And so that's the equality for delta, but if you look at the quality, so this delta does not act on omega, so it will hit directly here. But the Li derivative will act on omega on top of acting here, and this is what is going to introduce the anomalies. You reorganize, if you want to think in those terms, forget about these Li derivatives, you think in that term, you reorganize them, and you get to the same result, that the anomalies would be those.
It comes from a field redefinition.
From?
This
No, it comes from the presence of a background structure. There's no field redefinitions here plays no role. It comes from the fact that you have this omega.
But this is not just rescaling your field by a number.
Well, it comes from the fact that in your phase space you have a structure whose delta is zero, but whose Li derivative is non-zero.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I agree.
So everything whose definition depends on omega will be anomalous. Look at the shear. What is the shear? The shear is the first subleading order in the expansion of GAB. So how can you define it if you don't give me omega? So you see, the shear is a function of both the metric and the conformal factor. Because otherwise, how do you know that you have to pick up the first subleading order? In fact, it's worse than that, because in this formulation, it's also a function of the cross-section to the foliation you've chosen. That's why it actually has two anomalies. Because it doesn't just depend on omega, it also depends on the fact that there's this preferred bond defoliation. That's the second source of anomaly. Okay.
Thank you.
Actually, these anomalies are well known. They are the same in BMS and BMSW, so I'm going to talk about BMS from now on. When Ron has questions, we'll get back to BMSW. The metric anomaly is well known, because in BMS, the bond frames are fixed, so these things never change. But if we do the boost part of the BMS group, we change it by conformal transformation. So this discrepancy is well known. Now, the news anomaly here, it's also well known, because as shown by Gerock in 77, this guy doesn't transform, this is not invariant under conformal transformation. You need to subtract the trace-free part of his own the tensor that now carries his name in order to define something that is a conformal invariant, which is our statement for saying that it's anomaly-free. So now in this conference, this Gerock news has always been called the covariant news. So in some talks it was n hat, in some talks curly n, but that's the same thing I'm talking about. And in fact, to be fair, I think the better notation would be just to call this thing the news,
and remove the dot derivative of C, first of all, because this is the notation that is used by Gerock, Ashtekar, Wald, they call the news this, not just that. Second, because calling this a tensor is kind of stupid because, you know, it's a partial derivative. So what you really need is the Lie derivative along n of the shear, and that's exactly another independent definition of the news tensor. And for instance, Marius earlier on was using exactly this definition. So that is, should be called the news tensor rather than C dot. But anyways, I'm going to stick to n being C dot for the rest of the talk. So now that we have these formulas, let's go back to our question. Well, we take our candidate preferred potential and crap, it isn't. It is anomalous, it has this transformation here, so that means we cannot take it as preferred symmetric potential. However, this problem, I don't have to solve it because, as I said, Gerock solved it before I was born, and so all we have to do is to add and subtract Gerock tensor, and then these will be invariant. And to be fair, that's the definition of the canonical symmetric potential given in the Wald-Zupas paper. Now, this means that B is not going to be just these three terms. It's going to be these three terms plus what I've needed to add in order to get the Gerock term in here. So now you may say, well, all of these is for nothing. Who cares? Because anyway, we know that the beautiful property of the Gerock tensor is that it vanishes on the round two sphere. So numerically, it doesn't matter. I'm just adding zero. Well, but if you compute charges, it does matter. In exactly the same way as if you have a function that is worth zero at a point, but then you have to take the derivative of the functions. So if you forget it, you're going to get wrong results. In fact, let's see it explicitly. If I use the improving under charge formula for getting the contribution from the anomaly, this is what I get. So we see that these two m, I mean these units here, this is the famous correction of the factor of two wrong of the Komar formula. So that works. This gets Drey-Streubel's result perfectly already because that comes corrected from the vertical part in the BMS vector. But we have this piece that is left over. So we don't get yet the Wald-Zupas charges. And this nether charge will satisfy a flux balance law of this sort. But as explained earlier, the fact that we know that we're guaranteeing the equivalence requirement, it means that there is a leftover anomaly that I have to compute, and it will be exact. This turns out to be the case, because a quick calculation shows that that's the result you get with exactly the right numerical factor. This took us, we had forgotten initially a term. Initially, we forgot this term, and it wasn't working, we were desperate, but then we understood that this term was important, and then we got the right numerical factor here. So this cancels perfectly this guy, and then you get precisely the Wald-Zupas expression for the charges, and this is satisfied, meaning that this was exact, and you pull it back in there. So what do we conclude from this? There are soft anomalies ascribed. They're actually important. They enter in the soft terms. If you ignore them, and you don't use a prescription of Wald-Zupas, but you just take some improved nether charge with some given boundary Lagrangian, then you will get the memory effects with different numerical factors. So specifying them exactly is something that is given to you by the Wald-Zupas procedure. And it can also be understood as a corner correction, which is this one. Now, all of these actually is perfectly consistent, or I should say it was kind of more or less explicitly said already in this long paper. I think we are still contributing something in making it very explicit and talking explicitly about the various anomaly contributions. And if you look at this paper, you will see that this corner term is slightly different, but that's simply because we are using the tetrad formulation instead of the metric formulation. So just some minor caveats here, but in understanding the literature. But that's the key, these are the key takeaway messages. Now, to come back to the Dodonovan, no, really? No, I can't. No,
I'm just taking it. Ah. I'll bring it with me. This means you have 1 minute.
No, because I'm going to buy time. Because now I'm going to say that Wald-Zupas were kind of wrong in something, and so Laurent is going to be happy and want to hear me say more time. So let's make some useful historical remark. So this is the form of the soft anomalies. And in the BMS case, this is zero, and this it means that this is equal to this. So that means the Wald-Zupas could get away without ever talking about anomaly. But still, they must talk about field-dependent diffeomorphism at some point, because this term must be there. Otherwise, you don't get the right formula. And in fact, they do, but they do in a very intricate way, which basically, instead of appreciating that the right correction to get the Dreyer-Strobel boost comes from the vertical part, they used a very technical involved argument, which is correct, even though they don't give detailed proof, that by using a suitable extension, then they can uniquely select the Dreyer-Strobel, or if you want, the Yarok-Winokur expression for the boosts. So there's four papers that are very relevant for studying BMS symmetries. And Wolzopas is okay, even though the argument is rather indirect. I much prefer the paper of Glenn and Cedric, who I think are the first one that really got it spot on. They compute everything. There's no cheating, no indirect arguments. All the terms are there. And you can see how this term is needed to cancel a term that comes from the variation of the metric. This paper, I don't understand, because it gave an argument that for me is just wrong in order to get the Dreyer-Strobel angular momentum. And this paper also is a little bit weird, because they don't give it an argument of how they handle this, even though, of course, you can always say, I recognize that this cancels the variation of the comma charge and knows the xi depends at second order on the metric and ignore that part. So you could do it that way. But at least they should say it explicitly, and they don't. So at least I don't understand how these calculations are done. This is the one I do understand. And that's the one I recommend if you want to learn. Well, I have 10 seconds. I wanted to say this. OK, I won't have time to say this, but because I'm, look, Luca, your name is on the slide. You'll allow me to say something with your name on the slide?
You have 15 seconds.
How smart is that? You put the name, you see, at the last slide, you put the name of the...
I'm missing mine, so I'm going
to... But he's the chair, he's the chair. Well, anyway, OK, if I don't have time, then let me just give you the take-home messages, which is that the Wolzopas prescription works with this type of soft anomalies, and it gives you a prescription to get the improved net charge so that the anomalous flux is moved on the other side. And so these anomalies are actually very nice. They are useful to understand the co-cycles. They're useful to understand soft terms. So don't forget them. Don't be afraid of them. Use the formalism that we developed that allows you to treat them in the most general cases. And these are the two papers with Gloria Odak, who is here, and Antoine Rignon-Bray, who is in Marseille, that will appear very soon. And thank you very much. And,
Thanks a lot, Simone. We take questions. There were already a lot of questions during the talk. So if there are some more comments, Laurent, I'll try, yeah? Are you ready?
You mentioned, this puzzle that on flat space an alcohol expands and the charge are not conserved. So, what's the? Do you want to give a
resolution? I can get. It's not a puzzle. It shows the importance of the stationarity requirement. You see, where was it? Here. You see, you choose. A preferred symplectic potential that has the property that satisfies this requirement on non-expanding horizons. So it will give you conservation of charges on non-expanding horizons. But now you look at the Nalcon, that's not a non-expanding horizon, so you need a different prescription if you want charges that are conserved there.
So do you have one?
We have, yes, we'll publish an example of that. Yes.
You don't want to tell us?
Which, yeah. In fact, I initially thought I could talk about that, and then the title was Getting Rid of Fake News in Trump's Times, but we didn't finish yet, so I talked about this next time.
All right. Other questions for Simone? Very good. I think we're all tired, so give it up for Simone.